From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To The Point.
On Thanksgiving Day, it's all about food. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. You may think that today's traditional Thanksgiving meal is the same as it always was, but that's not necessarily so. The food Americans eat is changing. Farmers' markets are all the rage, and in grocery stores, consumers are reading nutrition labels on bottles and cans. With the celebrity chefs appearing on TV, cooking and eating habits are changing, but not everybody can afford to go green and organic. We'll hear about changes in food, in shopping, cooking, and eating, from upscale suburbs to urban ghettos and from region to region. On Reporter's Notebook later on, what is democracy? First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To The Point. Farmers' markets are all the rage, and school lunches are more nutritious than they used to be, but some urban American neighborhoods are food deserts with no grocery stores. We'll hear the good news and bad news and get some surprises today about how food and the way we eat it are changing. On Reporter's Notebook, a video on the shortcomings of democracy in the Philippines wins an award from the State Department. First, this news update. It's been exactly 1 year since the attack in Mumbai that killed 174 people in two hotels, a train station, a cafe, and a Jewish community center. It was reported afterward that Indian intelligence had received prior warnings, but that key weaknesses still left the city exposed. What's changed in the meantime? Stephen Cohen is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His new book about modernizing India's military will be called Arming Without Aiming. Stephen Cohen, welcome to our program.
Hello, Warren. Good to be with you again.
Thank you. Do we know for sure that the Pakistani group, Lashkar-e-Taiba, was responsible?
Well, I think we know 99.9% for sure. One man who was caught in Mumbai really told exactly where he came from and who trained him, and there's no question. And even the Pakistan government has admitted that LTE was involved.
Is India now better prepared to defend itself against that particular group?
Well, that's a subject of some debate in India, whether they're better prepared or not. I think they're better prepared for a similar kind of attack, but it's unlikely that exactly the same kind of attack will take place again. But I am pretty sure that there will be another attack in India. There are enough groups out there who want to destroy or disrupt India-Pakistan relations, want to hurt India. So I think India still remains vulnerable. But for the Indians, this was a lot like our 9/11, and it's led to significant organizational reforms. It's led to a change of policy and towards Pakistan, and I think it's also led to a change in Indian priorities in terms of their defense and security policy.
The Wall Street Journal reports that at least six new plots by that same group, Lashkar-e-Taiba, have been disrupted in the last year.
Yeah, and we don't know how many there were total and whether there are any that are in planning now. I'm not sure if the Pakistani government knows this, even though these plots are generally taking place on Pakistani soil.
So what then is are the kinds of changes that have taken place, and do they give you a sense of optimism about India's ability to defend itself?
Well, they did move quickly. The Manmohan Singh government exactly a year ago moved quickly to make some political changes, and they fired the home minister, who was technically responsible for internal security matters, and appointed a new man, actually a senior Congress politician who's very tough and very experienced. And what they're now doing, in fact, this is taking place over this weekend, over these days now, they're talking to the Americans about establishing an Indian Homeland Security Ministry, emulating some of the things that we did after 9/11. This was, for the Indians, something like a 9/11 in terms of the psychological and political impact.
We've seen, of course, the first state visit in the Obama administration by the Prime Minister of India. You're suggesting that meetings are continuing to go on. What's the U.S. role?
Well, I think we can provide examples. We can provide models. The Indians are looking around the world for these things. They look to the British and other countries. But above all, we can provide, and we have provided, even while the Mumbai attacks were taking place, intelligence cooperation at a level that we've never done before with India. In a sense, they trusted us, we trusted them. So the two various intelligence agencies were sharing information even as this was going on. In fact, a lot of the vital information about the Mumbai attackers came from the FBI, who's been deeply involved in this. And of course, they've just discovered another plot, another plotter, who was involved in the Mumbai attack, who's based in the United States.
And he is thought to have had something to do with the plan to attack the Danish newspaper that printed the cartoons of Muhammad.
Right, and he was possibly one of the people who carried out reconnaissance before the actual attack came over from Pakistan.
Now,
which makes it look more like as much like an Al Qaeda operation as an LED operation. But we still don't know the exact origins of this plot.
President Obama has made it pretty clear that he does intend to beef up the military presence in Afghanistan and also to establish a much more complex relationship with the government of Afghanistan. India has, of course, a relationship with Afghanistan, and that worries Pakistan. Can you unravel that?
Well, we're caught between two friends. Pakistanis are neuralgic about Indian presence in Afghanistan, possibly for good reasons, because the Indians see this as a way of countering Pakistani support for extremists in India. Yet the Indians have offered to help in Afghanistan, but it's not clear whether they would do anything in terms of supplying military forces. They're looking for a UN or international authorization to be present in Afghanistan. They don't want to put their troops under American direction, but they could do a lot in terms of training Afghan soldiers, improving Afghan administration, and of course, in economic development programs in Afghanistan. They've been doing this all along at a lower level than we have, of course, but still very persistent and enough to irritate the Pakistanis.
But are India and Pakistan more focused on each other than they are on the Taliban?
I think that's a fair statement. From the Pakistan Army's point of view, India is the first enemy, the second enemy, the third enemy, then comes the Taliban after that. In fact, the Pakistan military supporting the Taliban historically did support the Taliban. In a sense, they've been fighting both sides of this war, helping us and helping the Taliban. And of course, the Indians are deeply concerned not only about the Taliban, which doesn't border them, but about Pakistan going under as a radical Islamist state. That's why Prime Minister Manmohan Singh was so forceful in his support of the American presence in Afghanistan, perhaps even more forceful than any Pakistani leader has been.
All right. 1 year since the attacks on Mumbai. Stephen Cohen at Brookings, thanks very much to you. The upcoming book, Arming Without Aiming, in a moment on Thanksgiving Day. It's all about food on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Orman Alney back with To The Point. From posh neighborhoods to urban ghettos, from region to region, America's food is changing. So are the ways we produce it, buy it, cook it, and eat it. Kim Severson writes about food for the New York Times. Her next book will be Spoon Fed, How Eight Cooks Saved My Life. Kim Severson, good to have you on our program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
We'll wait till the book comes out to find out about the eight cooks and the influence they had on your survival.
Right.
Tell us about food trends, and what do you think is the most important way that food is changing in the United States right now on Thanksgiving Day?
Well, it's interesting. I think the most important thing is that people care about what they eat more than they have, I think, in many, many decades. And you can see that in a number of places. Just take farmers markets alone. It's they've increased over by 4,000 since 1995 or 1994 when the USDA started keeping track of them, and almost every city and small town now has a farmers market. I think you look at the school food reform movement, which a decade ago or so, a few schools started having chefs at the school cafeteria and talking about changing the way school kids eat, and now you see Michelle Obama, the First Lady, has taken up school food with a vengeance. She has a garden on the front lawn of the White House. Certainly how people eat, what they put into their bodies, is making a big difference. And I think with health care reform, you certainly can't ignore the effect food has on people's health. The obesity rates do not seem to be going anywhere but up, even though several corporations, school districts, governments have gotten deeply involved in trying to get people to exercise more and take in fewer calories. So, food's obviously a big player. Lots of and lots of games on the American table and on Thanksgiving. It's, I think, a really interesting time to sit and think about what we're eating.
Well, if there's more concern about what we're eating, whether it's healthy or not, if there are more farmers markets springing up, why is the obesity rate going up?
Well, you've heard of a dollar value menu. There's, you know, I think that food is also very cheap in this country, and it's very accessible. I think, the causes, I mean, not to be so flip, the causes of obesity are complex. There's certainly economics, a big factor of that. Lower income people tend to have higher rates of obesity because, the things you can get to fill up your belly that are cheap are not necessarily the healthier things. You know, people are strapped for time. If you're working a couple of jobs, if you're a single parent, it's harder to cook for yourself and to cook healthy food. And I think we make it really easy to have a drive-through kind of culture, to eat fast food. Plus the offerings that we've seen. I mean, it's amazing the portion size still in this country at restaurants and at fast food restaurants as well as sit down restaurants. So I think that's an issue. Clearly, a lot of us spend our time. I know I spend a lot of time in front of my computer. I'm not doing manual labor. I'm not in New York, so I do walk a lot. But I'm not out exercising, and I think most kids, when you talk to parents, you find out that their children get maybe one or two days of physical education. So we've got a multitude of problems that are adding to obesity. But I think that crisis has really fueled people's concern about the food supply and the kind of food that we're eating.
What has been the role, do you think, of the celebrity chefs on TV?
Celebrity chefs on TV, I'll tell you now, with YouTube, just about every home cook can be a celebrity chef on TV if they want to. I think that's kind of an interesting phenomenon. But at the same time, we've had the issues around the quality of food we've eaten on the lower level. I think on the high end, you've certainly seen I don't know if you went out trick or treating at all this Halloween. I'm guessing you probably didn't, but we had many, many chefs.
I beg your pardon. I have grandchildren. I did
and did any of them dress up like chefs?
Not that I saw.
Our neighborhood, no. We have plenty of chefs, and so you see, cooking is this sort of as a culture, as a cultural aspiration is huge, and a lot of kids grew up watching the Food Network. Their kids in college are wanting to cook a lot. With each other. In fact, that kind of cool thing on campus now, I was up at Yale, and they're all talking about these off-campus pig roasts. When I was in college, we went to off-campus keggers. Now you get the secret instructions to go to the off-campus pig roast. So I think you're finding, the influence of the TV chef, of the chef of celebrity, has been huge. And it's coincided with this awakening of American regional food that began in the 80s and kind of came out of the California cuisine movement in the 70s and the 80s. There was this big American food revolution. People were, cooking regional food and, they were discovering things in their own backyard, and that just continued into the 90s and the rise of Food Network and television. And so here we are with a whole full generation of a half that was raised on the Food Network, on celebrity chefs. So I think it's having a huge effect. And if you talk to kids, young people, being a chef, being on Top Chef, that's a very honorable profession. It wasn't always the case.
You say anybody can be a celebrity chef, really. What about the internet and the sharing of recipes and styles of cooking and all that?
Well, I think that is really where, at least for me as a food writer, I'm fascinated with the way that we can learn about how we cook through the internet. I'm working on a story that'll be in the New York Times and about looking at Thanksgiving as that we have a completely digital Thanksgiving right now. So you can find out, never before did we know how America cooked. We realized people were doing turkey, some pies, but you can actually, by following the search engines and the way people search online, figure out which states prefer pecan pie, which states prefer pumpkin pie, when they start looking for it, like 3 o'clock on Wednesday. People are looking for Parker House roll recipes by Thursday. By Thanksgiving at 3 in the afternoon, they're looking up gravy recipes because everybody's in a panic. So you really have the snapshot through search about how this nation cooks, and it's fascinating. And YouTube, the how-to videos on YouTube for cooking was one of the fastest-growing areas, and certainly recipe sites, Epicurious, All Recipes, any recipe site right now. People who try to make money off of or monetize food. We all have to monetize everything now, but people who are monetizing food are doing it online, doing it through, you're trying to come up with that one food website that's really going to hit.
Kim Severson again writes about food for the New York Times. Marion Nessel is professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. She is the author of the book, What to Eat. Marion Nessel, good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
How is the food industry relating to this, and how has it in some ways become political?
Well, I think we're in the middle of a food social movement, as Kim described beautifully. And as with all social movements, industrial agriculture is co-opting the movement for its own purposes. So we have industrial organic, we have industrial natural. You can hardly go into a food store and find something that doesn't have a health claim on it. So it's part of the health movement as well. It's the only thing that sells food these days. And even though the percentage of people who buy and are really deeply interested in natural, organic, seasonal, and so forth is still a pretty small percentage of the population, it's a pretty influential percentage. They're the people who read the New York Times and go to elite colleges. And so they have a great deal of influence, and it's clear that this is the direction that the food industry has to go.
Is there a backlash to this? Let me go back to Kim Severson on this one. Is there a backlash to this in the sense that it is, to some extent, still located in the upper echelons, if I may, of our society, at least economically?
I think that's changing a lot, and I think it's easy to look at it and say, okay, you know, food in a farmer's market costs more than food at a Walmart, and so therefore this is an elitist movement. But I think there's a real coming together of what have been traditionally different ends of the food movement. You have people who are working on hunger issues who really traditionally thought, you know, a calorie is a calorie, and we just have hungry people, and whatever we can get in their bellies, we're going to get in. And then you had people who were quite happy to spend lots of money at farmers markets and on artisan food and, you know, going to the Dean and DeLuca's and not really thinking about it. But people that the tastemakers, the people who maybe have money to really and time to really think about what they eat, that elite food group, I think has had a real awakening about the fact that if everybody's going to have better food, they've got to start doing some work to get healthy food to those communities where people can't afford to have it. So you see farmers markets where now you can get like double the value of your food stamps at farmers markets, and that's come about through government, but also through, you know, the slow foodies of the world who really felt like they were kind of missing the boat when it came to hunger and social justice, and that this is part of a bigger thing we're all in together. So slowly you're seeing that gap narrow, and you're seeing people in who work with hunger groups realizing that teaching people to cook, teaching them to cook healthy food and delicious food really does matter in terms of getting people, to feel better about what they're eating. So I do think it's changing, although certainly, you know, I always make the point that a farmer's market is something of kind of a theater of luxury, you know, these days. It's changing, but, you know, it's a place where you have to, people who go there have the time to go there, you have the leisure time, you know, you have the money to spend $12 on a sausage, which used to be peasant food, you know. So it is kind of, I mean, certainly there's something to the fact that it takes time and money to shop at a farmer's market or to buy this kind of food, but it is changing.
Professor Nessel, back to you. You said the food industry has co-opted the food movement. Everything says organic. Everything says natural. You can't sell the food any other way. Is it really what it appears to be?
Oh, sometimes yes, sometimes no, often no. The best examples that I can think of are what's going on with health claims these days, where we've had two instances in the last month or so where food companies have had to back off advertising their food as healthy because it was demonstrably ridiculous. One is the Smart Choices program, which put a check mark on foods as sugary and processed as Fruit Loops, and the other was the immunity claim on Cocoa Krispies, which, you know, got the state attorney generals and city attorney generals very interested in deciding whether they had evidence to back this up.
Is there, though, a difference from state to state? Can you still call Fruit Loops healthy in some parts of the country?
Well, you can call Fruit Loops healthy any place you want to. Whether it's real or not is another matter. We still have veggie libel laws, although I don't know what's happening with them these days. Nobody thinks that they'll hold up in court, and their purpose is just to discourage criticism of the food supply. But we know we need a better food supply. We know we need a food supply that's sustainable, meaning that replenishes the things that we're taking out of the soil and water. And we know we need that. We need to be working in that direction. And I think everybody wants, everybody that I know who's active in food issues wants the same kind of food, high quality food and food that's good for people in the environment to be available to everybody.
What about that White House garden that Michelle Obama has installed? What about the president's preference for arugula? Does that make them part of a sort of elite food group? Or does that help to spread the idea of good nutrition to people who wouldn't otherwise be thinking about it?
Well, I suppose there will always be people who will put it down for being elitist. And it's, you know, when I hear that argument that this is an elitist movement, I usually translate that as these are people who feel that their economic status is being threatened in some way by this way of by this new way of thinking about food and wanting higher quality food. So I'm very suspicious of the argument, even though I think it has a grain of truth. But the reason that that high-quality food is more expensive has to do with policy. I mean, there's a reason why fast food is cheap. There's a reason why high-calorie, sugary, salty, fatty foods are inexpensive, and that has to do with our agricultural policy. Agricultural policies are not set in stone. They can be changed. And I think what everybody on the industrial side is worried about right now is that there's a big movement to change them.
So is the government then subsidizing at the moment the wrong kind of food?
Absolutely, without any question. It subsidizes corn, the basis of high fructose corn syrups, soybeans, the basis of soy oil and soy ingredients. And it doesn't subsidize, at least not very much, fruits and vegetables, which it still considers specialty crops.
The agricultural bill comes up every few years, and there's an argument about this, invariably pointing out that some of the people in Congress themselves are the beneficiaries of these subsidies. What prospect do you see for this changing?
Well, I think we need to change our election campaign laws. I mean, let's get down to fundamentals. If we want to end corruption in government in this country, we have to find some independent way of funding election campaigns so that our elected officials aren't beholden to corporations, and then we could have people in Congress who aren't so rich, maybe, and could represent a wider fraction of the American public. But that's pipe dreams. Why not?
Well, we're talking about food, and you would think that this would be going far afield, but you're suggesting there's a real important relationship between the food we eat and the politicians we elect.
Well, I write about food politics, so it's the area that I'm concerned about. But I think one of the things about food that I like teaching and I like thinking about is that it connects to absolutely everything. You want to do something about climate change, you have to change the way we do agriculture.
Marion Nessel again, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. We'll come back with her, with Kim Severson and others in just a moment on our reporter's notebook, an international video project, What is Democracy? We'll talk to one of the winners. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point on Thanksgiving Day, talking today about the changes in the food that we eat and the way that we eat it, the move to organic local food and the hope for sustainable agriculture, if we can ever get past the pattern of governmental subsidies. We've also heard about what's something called the hunger movement referred to by Kim Severson. Mari Gallagher runs the Community Development Consulting Group, a community consulting group in Chicago, and she studies access to food and public health, and it's good to have you on our program.
I'm so happy to be here. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. Who's been left out of all this?
That's a good question. I know you were talking earlier about whether or not this is an elitist movement, and I'm not going to really address that question so much, but I will say that there are a number of people across the country, thousands really, who would maybe like to choose healthy food but don't have access to it. We call these areas food deserts. Food deserts are large geographic areas that cluster but have no or distant mainstream grocery stores. You can imagine if you're going through a regular kind of desert looking for water, that's how it is in a food desert, except you're looking for food. And it's not that there's no food in the food desert. There's some food, but as you heard earlier from your other guests, that you know this is not necessarily healthy food. It's chips and soda, you know, packaged high salt, high fat, sugary foods, but very, very little nutritious food. So these foods are food deserts, and in some areas we have thousands and thousands of people. Just in one city, in Chicago, for example, we have over 600,000 residents who live in a food desert. And what we find in Chicago, Detroit, other parts of the country, is that these residents are more likely to suffer and die prematurely from diet-related diseases like diabetes, hypertension, certain kinds of cancer, cardiovascular conditions, and so on, after we control for other factors like income, race, and education. So it's a very, very serious problem. And, you know, we can preach about how many fruits and vegetables we should all eat, but if you don't have access to them, it's very, very difficult to choose them. So in that respect, I would say that these residents are left out.
Well, they're there. They presumably have some money. They have to eat, and they buy something, whether they have to go to the convenience store or the liquor store in order to get it. Why don't grocery stores move into these food deserts?
Well, that's a very complicated question. We've been looking at that very question for many years, and there are many, many reasons, and it's not always the same set of reasons, market to market to market. But in many of these areas, we have a problem with what we call agglomeration, and it's a very Yogi Berra problem, if you will, and that is that grocers don't go where grocers aren't already. So retail attracts retail. So in many of these markets, because everyone, you know, does eat, many of these markets can sustain a regular grocery store, but because there are no grocery stores already there, it's hard to attract that retail cluster because retail tends to locate around other retail. In other cases, you know, in some cases, crime is a little bit higher or land might still be very expensive. It's hard to put deals together in certain areas, especially in certain kinds of cities where there's lots of politics. And then the margin for selling food is very, very tight. And so you have to, you know, really demonstrate that you're going to, you know, make that return on investment in order to put that store in. So there's lots of different reasons. But as you said, everyone does eat. Eating is part of the human condition. So there is a sustainable market in many of these food desert areas for food. It's just a matter of getting either the grocer to move in or looking at other kinds of good food options.
You mentioned Chicago. You mentioned Detroit. What are you doing in those and other cities in order to try to deal with this situation?
Oh, well, there's the interesting thing about this puzzle is there's not one single problem or one single solution. It looks a little different place to place. But the good news about that is it means that everybody can do something. So you know, in Chicago, for example, we're working with a number of industry leaders on six strategic sites for grocers to move into, and we've actually measured how much public health return there would be if these stores moved in. And so we can actually measure how years of life gained instead of life lost would be brought back to these communities from diabetes, from certain kinds of cancers, and so on, after we control for other factors. So we're using data in some places to recruit grocers. We're also working on corner store improvements. In Los Angeles, there's a really exciting group called WORKS that we're working with, and that stands for Women Organizing Resources, Knowledge, and Services, and they're an affordable housing developer. They have five key sites, and so they're doing a number of exciting programs linking farmers directly to their housing residents and kind of skipping retail altogether and hiring residents to be part of that entrepreneurial process and selling bags of produce for $15 a bag. And they have nutrition classes and cooking classes, and so they're doing a whole range of different things. In Birmingham, Alabama, there's a group that we're working with that wants to do a public market in lots of locations all across the U.S. We're looking at farmers markets and urban agriculture, and even in rural areas, it's very, very surprising that in many places where historically we've had such strong bonds with, you know, how to cook food and where food comes from and having our own little gardens, and now today in many of these communities, they're not producing the kind of food that you can actually eat. I mean, you can't really feed your family on number two corn or other kinds of things. And so we've become, in many areas, even rural areas, more disenfranchised from, you know, where food comes from and how to get affordable, healthy, good food.
One of the problems with fast food, it seems to me, is that it often tastes good. Is it difficult to get people to change their diets when you try to get them to eat food that comes from farmers markets and food that's healthier and less likely to give them obesity and other kinds of problems that lead to an early death?
Right. Well, the food is pretty cheap and tasty and so on, and I agree with you. It doesn't happen overnight, so we don't see these changes overnight in terms of, you know, once you have access, what folks will choose, and then, you know, of course, you don't see the health benefits overnight. It's all a process. So one of the things that we're looking at is kind of identifying where consumers are on the continuum of, you know, choosing these healthy foods and really helping them with realistic interventions, you know. So, for example, if the continuum is 1 to 10, with 10 being, wow, you're choosing all these great foods, you're doing all this wonderful exercise, you're really, you know, in a great place with your food and health, you know, if the scale is 1 to 10 and folks are at a 2 or a 3, it's unrealistic to try to move them to, you know, a 9 or a 10. And so trying to intervene and help folks where they can make the greatest improvements. And I don't think that's just the case with poor people or food desert residents, but all of us have difficulty, improving diet and health choices. And so that's something that we can all work on. And I think taking, you know, incremental steps, you know, will really be good for all of us and help us keep up those good diets and the good exercise routine over time.
All right. Mari Gallagher, again, running a community development consulting group in Chicago, leading us very gracefully into our next guest, who is Brian Wansink, who is a professor of eating behavior. He's also director of the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab and author of the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. His website is mindlesseating.org. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Well, I'm very pleased to be with you. Thank you.
Well, what have you found out that you can tell us about eating behavior and how that has changed?
You know, an interesting thing that we've found over the years is we're trying to look at how the calories in foods have changed as the years have gone by. And so we took every issue of the Joy of Cooking. It's been published since 1936, and what we found is that every article that's been common to all eight of those issues, when analyzing them, we found that the average recipe has increased in calories by 44% over the years. About two-thirds of that's due to more caloric ingredients, us deciding we want to put the whole stick of butter in or adding sugar, but then about a third of it's due to just bigger portions. But what's interesting, if we look specifically at just Thanksgiving meals, we took the Better Homes and Gardens from the 50s, from 1956, and compared it to that from 2006, and there's very little shift in the calories in a Thanksgiving meal. They've stayed fairly constant in all these recipes over the 50 years. It's kind of like you don't mess with classics. But what we do suspect is going on is that the recipe that is made for 8 or 12, well, that worked really well 50 years ago. If you went to your sister's house, you probably had 8 or 12 people there. If you go today, you probably have more like 6 or 8. And I think there's a lot more food. We found that plates are about 30% larger than they were in 1960. And these two things, I think, lead us to believe people are eating a whole lot more in terms of portions, even if the calories are the same.
Well, now, what does the plate size have to do with the portions? Why do you have to eat a bigger portion just because the plate's bigger?
You know, you don't have to, but what happens is, what's the right amount to eat? Well, it's whatever looks right. And let's say you have a 10-inch plate, which is about the size plates were back in 1960, 10 and a quarter inches. If you put 3 ounces of dressing on a 10 and a quarter inch plate, man, it looks like a plateful. You put that same 3 ounces a 12-and-a-half-inch plate, which is what most of us are going to be using at dinner, it doesn't look like a serving at all. I mean, it looks just like a little appetizer bit. So what do? You naturally put on a little bit more. And what we found is that on average, people will serve about 28% more simply going from a 10 to a 12-inch plate. But they won't realize they've eaten any more.
Why are plates larger? Is there a conspiracy between the food industry and the people that make the plates?
Yeah. That is somewhat a good question. You know, there's a number of reasons. People are a lot larger than they were, but they're not just heavier, that we're also taller. So there's something that happened over the last 50 years that have inched those things up. Yeah, pretty soon we'll just be eating off the platter, I guess.
How subjective is the matter of the way food tastes, and to what extent can it be manipulated by marketing?
Oh, it can be manipulated tremendously, not just by marketing, it can be manipulated by grandmothers. It can be manipulated by us when we have people over for dinner. Within a range, there's tremendous subjectivity when we taste food. You never go to a restaurant and have your partner say, "Hey, taste this appetizer, it tastes really good." You never taste and go, "Oh, it's terrible." Now, we've got this confirmation bias when it comes to food. If we think it's going to taste good, we taste it looking for the qualities that will make it good. If, on the other hand, we think it's going to taste terrible, like with broccoli, some people think, we taste it actually looking for why we hate it. Now, food companies do the same thing our grandmothers did. They say, "Hey, this is going to be delicious, it's going to be juicy, it's classic, it's mouth-watering." All those things essentially trigger us to have this positive bias to like that food once we taste it.
And I take it then that that is an easy thing to manipulate, but you could manipulate it in the other direction too.
Yeah, and both ways. You know, there's an interesting conversation a little bit earlier with Kim Severson and Dr. Nessel about the organic stuff. We did a neat study a while back where we took a bunch of people and we gave them a lot of different foods, some which were organic and some which were not. But what we'd do is we'd change the labels. We'd either tell people it was organic or we wouldn't tell them at all. And we'd mix up all these labels and all these foods. And we found that for certain segments of people, if they believed something was organic, they rated it as a lot tastier, as less caloric, as more natural tasting, as more rich, even though it's the exact same food as the non-organic, even though it's the exact same food as the one labeled differently. But what we found is this happened primarily with three different sort of groups of people. And it wasn't necessarily the culinary elitists, but the people who were most influenced by these labels of organic ended up either being dieters, they ended up being people who were self-classified as foodies, or they ended up being with people who claimed to cook at home three or more nights a week. I guess the one big group that was pretty much unmoved by that label is basically guys.
Guys, they're responsible for a lot of the problems in the world. There's no question about it.
I like my food hot and massive.
There
yeah,
you go.
Exactly.
Professor Brian Wansink at Cornell University. Marion Nessel, back to you at New York University. Why do you think the plates are larger?
Oh, I think it's because the food industry had to figure out ways to sell food. Starting in the early 1980s, we had a change in agricultural policy that created a sharp increase in the amount of food produced in the United States. And we went from 3,200 calories a day for every man, woman, and child in the country to 4,000 calories a day in just a few years. And food companies had to find ways to sell that food. And because food is subsidized, certain kinds of foods are subsidized, food was cheap. And they could sell more of it by making larger portions. And once you start larger portions, you have to create the hardware that goes along with that. So that means larger plates, larger muffin pans, larger cup holders in automobiles and so forth. And people love larger portions. And Brian is being way too modest about his work, but he's shown absolutely without any question that anybody, even his own trained students, will eat more calories from a larger portion than from a smaller portion.
Nobody wants to leave anything on the plate? Is that a legacy of the Depression?
No, I don't think so. I think it's hardwired. I think there's something so basic about having food in front of you, you just want to eat it, especially if it tastes good. And even if it doesn't taste good, one of the things his work has shown, that even if it doesn't taste good, people eat more of it, if there's more of it presented. So there must be something hardwired in there. Brian, do that experiment.
How about that, Brian Wansink?
Well, actually, we did an experiment just outside of Chicago. We invited people, and if you ask the typical person why they overeat, they typically will say they overeat because they're really, really hungry or because the food is really, really good. We decided to see what would happen if people who are not hungry are given food that is not good. Can they still be tricked by their environment? We brought people, or people came to this movie theater, and we gave them either these really large buckets of popcorn, or we gave them the tremendously, tremendously large buckets of popcorn. But this was five-day-old stale popcorn that we had had in an entomologist in a sterile entomology lab for 5 days, just collecting humidity. And it didn't matter the fact that this popcorn was terrible and that people weren't hungry. They ended up eating 34% more popcorn if they were given this super huge container. But the thing is, if you ask them if the container had anything to do with it, to a person, they would deny having been influenced by anything. So plebeian is the size of a container. And this is the problem. These cues around us are so ubiquitous, yet we think we're too smart to be fooled by the size of a plate or how far away the serving bowl is sitting from us on the table or by what the person's doing across from us. And that's one of the reasons that we found people tend to overeat so much because of their environment.
Eating behavior, a fascinating study. Quickly, Kim Severson, back to you, a food writer for The New York Times. In the fashionable dining rooms of New York, do people have bigger plates?
They have bigger plates and little, tiny, expensive entrees. No, actually, what's happening, and it's very interesting, people are sort of taking it upon themselves to reject the bigger plates and the bigger entrees, and something restaurateurs are seeing is that people are ordering two appetizers instead of an appetizer and an entree and a dessert. I think diners are feeling a little more confident to break away from what a restaurant owner wants to sell you, which is that much food, and realizing that, two appetizers can do quite a good job filling you up. So I think people are making smarter choices about that. I know a lot of people who just wave away the bread basket when it comes to their table, and it's not an Atkins thing. I think it's just this idea is, I can eat, I might as well eat something I really, really want to eat. And if you look at some of the big chefs in town, and I don't mean, I guess I mean that literally and figuratively. Mario Batali has lost a lot of weight lately. I mean, he's still not a small guy, but his business partner in New York City, Joe Bastianich, is running marathons now. Used to be a really big guy. I think this notion that just excess and big plates and big portions, and eating until you're just, eating without thought is changing at the high-end level. I think diners don't want it anymore, and I think chefs are realizing that there's no win just by piling the food on for people at that level.
We will see if it trickles down, as we say. Kim Severson, again, writes about food for The New York Times. Her next book, Spoonfed, How Eight Cooks Saved My Life. Brian Wansink, our professor of eating behavior at Cornell. His book, Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. His website, mindlesseating.org. Marion Nessel, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Her book, What to Eat. And Mari Gallagher, running a community development consulting group in Chicago, studying access to food and public health. Many thanks to all of you for being with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
For the second year in a row, the U.S. State Department is challenging people around the world to talk about democracy and what it means. They're asked to produce videos no more than 3 minutes long, completing the sentence, "Democracy is." We'll talk with one of this year's winners in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
Werman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. As part of its public diplomacy, the U.S. State Department last year launched the Worldwide Democracy Video Challenge. Long Live the Fearless Man was the 2009 winner from the East Asia and Pacific region. Melissa Angela Verosa Peñafiel is the co-producer and director, and she took on the state of democracy in her own country, the Philippines, where corruption runs rampant and where more than 50 people were massacred this week in pre-election violence. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you find out about this?
I found out about a contest through the internet. They posted an advertisement in Yahoo groups, and so I just stumbled upon it. And it said that you have to define democracy in 3 minutes, which is, it's a very difficult concept to define and even grasp. So I was very intrigued about it. And since you don't have to submit anything via post mail, or you just have to upload the video online through YouTube, I said, hey, why not, you know? And I did the video with my partner. Both of us have been wanting to create a film with social significance.
How would you describe your completion of the sentence, democracy is, as represented by the film?
Democracy is, for us, not just one concept. You know, what we did with the video is we tried to shed light on the other side of democracy, not the one that we celebrate about, but we wanted to shed light on the problems that we have on democracy. So with this film, we tried to describe democracy and define it as how we experience it here in the Philippines.
It's a black and white video. It is darkly lit. It has a man's body with words written on it. What are some of the most important ideas that are expressed?
We wanted to make it dark, and we set it as black and white because we wanted to show how we have a lot of problems with our democracy. I mean, of course, each country has their own problems with democracy, but at the same time, we just wanted to promote critical thinking and show that these are the problems and how can we do something about it. You know, so it was really dark because, unfortunately, that's how we experience it.
It's experienced more in the promise than it is in the reality, I would say, having looked at the film.
Actually, for us, it was a realistic take. I mean, democracy can be a really idealistic idea, but for us, we just wanted to grasp the reality of democracy and how we experience it.
What does it say, or elaborate on that by telling us what it means to say we ourselves handed the hangman our own noose?
What we meant by that is how we as citizens are actually responsible for our own actions as being part of democracy, even though that we are bound with all these problems surrounding it, we are still responsible with how we act.
So it's a call for action, I take it. And are you hoping that it will be seen not just in the Philippines, but elsewhere too?
Yes, definitely. And I think that's the beauty of this contest, is how you can express yourself freely, upload it online on YouTube, which is a global platform, and you'll have people watching the video and giving their comments about it. And these people aren't just going to be your own fellow countrymen, but, you know, people from around the world. So it definitely invoked a global dialogue about democracy.
You came to Washington to the State Department, met with Hillary Clinton. Do you think that this competition has improved your perception of America? Is this a good thing for the United States in terms of international diplomacy?
It is, of course, in a way that it tries to bring people together. Like, for example, the six winners, all of us came from different regions around the world, and we came together to the U.S. for the package trip, and it was great meeting all these people, you know, and having to watch all of their films and seeing them talk about their films as well. It was really fascinating. At the same time, I think not just among us six, but to all those who participated, it's a good opportunity, you know, to, as a filmmaker or a videographer, to be a part of a global dialogue. So I think that it does help the U.S. in some way. But at the same time, I don't think that it was just about that, but it's more of just promoting what democracy is and what it means to each one of us.
As we indicated earlier, it is dark. Were you surprised that, given the fact that some of the U.S. consulates were involved in the judging process and, of course, the State Department sponsoring it in the first place, that it was accepted by the State Department and was a winner?
Yes, I have to say that we were surprised, my partner and I, when we found out. Because we just created the film as an expression about what we feel about our democracy here. We never expected that other people would even notice it. But at the same time, it's such a, you know, it's a good surprise because it means that people are open to listen to this kind of theme, which is what the idea was all about, you know, to invoke them to be critical about democracy.
Well, Issa Peña-Fiel, thank you very much for talking to us today. Again, the co-producer of Long Live the Fearless Man, the three-minute video done with the State Department's Democracy Video Challenge. They want more entries and we'll have on our own website, kcrw.com/to the point, a link for people who want to participate and also a link for those who want to watch Long Live the Fearless Man. Thank you again for being on our program.
Thank you very much for having me, and I hope that this will promote the contest more and more people will join it.
Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Karen Ranziner and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Armin Alney. Happy Thanksgiving. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.